power. It's just a matter of figuring out how to bring their abundant energy down to Earth. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear with help from Sarah Pryor in geography. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. For podcasts, click on the podcast button. I'm Don Glass.
Support for WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, who, along with Chef Benjamin, will hold a 200-wine catered benefit gala for Crisis Nursery on October 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Refinery on John Street in Champaign. Tickets are available at the Corkscrew and the Refinery. Information at 217-337-7704.
It's 2:41 in sports. Hunter Hillenmeyer is expected to start at middle linebacker for the Chicago Bears on Sunday against the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Bears have also signed linebacker Tim Shaw following Brian Urlacher's season-ending wrist surgery. Shaw was cut by Jacksonville in the preseason. St. Louis Cardinals right-hander Adam Wainwright will be the first 19-game winner in the majors this season if he can get a victory tonight against the Florida Marlins. The Cardinals maintain a 9.5-game lead in the National League Central. The Chicago Cubs will try to make it 7 wins in their last 8 games tonight when they take on the Milwaukee Brewers again at Wrigley Field. 8-game winner Carlos Zambrano will get the start for the Cubs. And the Chicago White Sox continue their West Coast road trip tonight in Seattle. Freddie Garcia will pitch against the Mariners in the opener of a 3-game series. That's sports.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Joyce Foundation and the USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
It's 2:42. The U.S. Internal Revenue Service says time is running out. Americans who have evaded taxes by using offshore accounts have less than 10 days to turn themselves in without the risk of going to jail. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
Wealthy Americans trying to evade taxes have often used offshore bank accounts, and bank secrecy laws have made it hard to find the tax cheats. But last month, as part of a court settlement, Swiss banking giant UBS agreed to turn over the names of about 4,500 Americans who the U.S. believes may be involved in tax fraud. They and others with unreported foreign accounts have a chance to come clean, but the deadline is September 23rd. They'll have to pay back taxes and penalties, but in general, they won't be prosecuted criminally and won't be subject to even stiffer penalties. Seattle University law professor Lily Kong says the government is taking a pragmatic approach, noting tax fraud is hard to prove.
These are wealthy, sophisticated taxpayers who will fight the IRS every step of the way. So as a practical matter, I think the IRS may be saying, well, let us just cut our losses here and try to collect what we can.
Seattle attorney Robert McCallum says dozens of people have contacted his firm for help in going to the IRS.
They're intimidated with the prospect of the IRS discovering what was previously a secret bank account.
Apparently, lots of people are intimidated. According to the government, in a single week of July, roughly 400 people turned themselves in. That's far more than in all of 2008. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
It was a year ago today that the government began planning the takeover of AIG to prevent the collapse of this, the largest insurance company in the world. Just about everyone seemed outraged that taxpayers had to save a private company. Congress vowed to rewrite the rules of American finance to prevent any bailouts in the future. Democrats and Republicans will now spend much of the fall battling over regulatory changes. Adam Davidson and Alex Bloomberg from NPR's Planet Money team have discovered that getting Democrats and Republicans to agree is sometimes the easy part.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the nightmare that is regulatory reform, a world where even universal consensus means nothing.
Pretty much everyone agrees, the Democrats or Republicans, we have too many regulators, just way too many. We should merge a bunch of them.
That's right. Take AIG. They were watched over by 400 different agencies around the world, dozens in the U.S., and nobody noticed that the company was on the verge of taking down the entire global economy.
This problem we're talking about, it has a name. Economists call it regulatory arbitrage. That's when more than one regulator oversees the same kind of activity. Financial firms always find a way to play one of them off against the other.
It's like what every four-year-old has figured out. If mommy won't let you, maybe daddy will.
Or worse, if mommy thinks daddy is watching you and daddy thinks mommy is watching you, well, you can get away with just about anything.
So, Adam, there's something else Democrats and Republicans agree on. The simple solution to this problem of regulatory arbitrage is never going to happen. Take one of the most glaring examples, the bizarre division of labor between the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
You know those exchanges where you see all the traders yelling at each other, buying and selling stocks or pork belly futures or whatever? That's what these guys regulate. And they divide things in a weird way. If you buy and sell stocks, your overseer is the SEC. If you buy and sell stock index futures and other things that take place in the future, you get the CFTC.
Much of this crisis is linked to all sorts of strange financial products that fell between the cracks of the SEC and the CFTC.
Jeb Hensarling, a Republican congressman from Texas who is one of the staunchest free market advocates, says this makes no sense. Merge them into one. That way, none of these financial products get overlooked.
Barney Frank, the Democrat from Massachusetts, the ideological opposite of Jeb Hensarling, he agrees.
Obviously, we all know now, anybody, that it would have been better not to have had two separate entities. It would be better to have just one. It is now and will be politically impossible to put the two together.
See what we mean? Barney Frank is one of the most powerful people in Congress when it comes to financial reform issues. He wants the SEC and the CFTC to merge. He says so all the time. And he is one man who knows better than anybody why it never will.
Actually, Adam, there's this one other guy who might know even better than Barney Frank.
Barney didn't want to fight that fight. And he saw what I went through and he just figured it's just not worth it. And I think he's probably right.
This is Mike Oxley. He used to have Barney Frank's job as chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. The Financial Services Committee oversees one of these two agencies that we're talking about, the SEC.
Oxley was a Republican representative from Ohio. He says this crazy system of two agencies looking over the same thing comes out of ancient financial history. The SEC was created to look over stock traders, who were mostly in New York. The CFTC started life as a different agency to look over the activities of farmers trading grain futures, mostly in Chicago.
These grain traders loved their regulator, which lived in a basement of the Department of Agriculture. They saw it as friendly and easy to work with, and they fought every effort from the larger New York-focused SEC to come to town and watch over things, which is why the CFTC today is still overseen by the Agriculture Committee.
Over the last 30 years, it's been harder to tell the difference between securities in New York and futures in Chicago, most of which today have nothing to do with grain or anything that comes from farms. But as former Financial Services Committee Chair Mike Oxley discovered, once you create two agencies, it's really hard to convince them to merge into one.
Oxley tried in the early 2000s and got nowhere, which he's sure is just where Barney Frank would get if he tried to do it as well.
Basically, you go to the speaker and the speaker say, are you out of your mind? And that would be the end of it, which is exactly what I did.
Right.
But I knew it was an uphill battle to begin with. And so I had some people close to me in leadership and went to them and I got the word. So, I mean.
You mean you went to other people like the.
Oh, sure.
And they said, forget it, pal. Don't fight this.
Pretty much, yeah.
So one question, why is this a fight? Why are people battling over the right to regulate financial futures? We got some insight on this from Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who's a good person to talk to about this. He was in the House and the Senate on the Banking and Agriculture Committees. And in fact, he was a Democrat and a Republican at different points in his career.
He said, imagine if the Speaker of the House takes one of these two agencies away from a committee chairman. That chairman would be really miserable.
He loses a group that may be very interested in getting him reelected, as an example.
I see.
Which it relates to, money for reelection and all kinds of stuff, votes for reelection.
And is it as straightforward as I want that group of lobbyists to keep giving me money?
Nope. I think it's much more subtle than that.
You can look at this whole thing really cynically. If I'm a committee chairman, I don't want to give up those big donations from lobbyists.
Or you can look at it just sort of cynically. The more a chairman oversees, the bigger the budget he gets, the more staff, the nicer office, cooler congresspeople want to be on his committee, it's easier to trade favors in exchange for votes that benefit his constituents.
Or dare we say it, you can look at this really idealistically. The more you oversee, the more power you have to make the world a better place.
The point is, whatever kind of congressperson you are, you want to hold on to your jurisdiction. Which means the way Congress works, it's almost impossible to end regulatory arbitrage.
Even right now, 1 year after regulatory arbitrage helped cause that huge financial crisis, Mike Oxley says trying to merge those agencies is like beating a dead horse.
Worse than beating a dead horse.
That horse is not only dead, but it's been dissected and ground up for horse meat. Give it up.
Once you give up, you can have peace with it.
Just like I'm never going to beat Tiger Woods, all right? I've come to terms with that issue.
What do you think's more likely, that you'll beat Tiger Woods or the CFTC and the SEC will merge?
Oh, I'll beat Tiger Woods before the CFTC and the SEC are merged, yeah.
A few months ago, Barney Frank and Colin Peterson, the chairman of the Financial Services Committee and the Agriculture Committee, announced that the SEC and the CFTC would stay separate. But they'd all work together more closely.
And this month, the two agencies held their first ever joint meeting, complete with all sorts of finance experts, to discuss ways to prevent financial products from slipping through the cracks.
And at that very meeting, some of those experts said, hey guys, you shouldn't be two agencies talking about working together. You should merge. You should be one. I'm Alex Bloomberg.
And I'm Adam Davidson, NPR News, New York.
Businesses keep track of the supply chain, but no one really keeps track of trash in the same way. Lester Graham reports some researchers think there's something to learn from what we throw away.
MIT researchers plan to keep track of some trash using smart tags, tiny electronic sensors. They'll tag thousands of pieces of trash, like plastic bottles, then they'll track them online in real time. Asaf Biederman is with the MIT Sensible City Lab. He says already the public seems interested, but he hopes some other people follow along, like big city decision makers and waste disposal companies.
Who could benefit greatly from a better understanding of how garbage moves through the system with the idea of making their processes as good as possible.
Save some fuel, maybe.
Save some fuels, be better to the environment. I think everybody can benefit.
Exhibits in New York and Seattle open this week, but starting tomorrow, anyone can follow the trail of trash online at MIT's Trash Track website. For the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham.
Furniture stores and architectural firms get a lot of samples of fabric, tiles, carpet. Those samples can pile up. Usually, they get thrown in the trash. But in some cities now, they're starting to make unused design samples available to artists and art teachers. Julie Grant has more.
Anita Gardner is rummaging through boxes of old tile samples. They're still attached to those threefold sample books you'd see at a design store. But she's imagining what else the kids at her community center might make with them.
You have to see it first sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't come, but comes later, and then you go, oh, goodness, we can do this and we can do that.
Gardner is at a special event called Zero Landfill. Furniture stores, architect, and design firms can drop off unwanted materials, and people like Gardner can take whatever they want for free.
This has been a godsend to us because we really don't have a lot of money to spend on arts and crafts.
Last year, she found a lot of unused fabrics, so she taught the kids at her center how to sew quilts.
And a lot of children in our community have never even threaded a needle. Now they're learning to use sewing machines. They're learning to piece all types of fabrics together. They're learning patterns and designs. They have no idea they're actually learning math.
And in inner-city neighborhoods where kids can go to bed cold in the winter, Gardner is especially pleased that she started a quilt-making trend. It also warms the hearts of the folks who organize Zero Landfill. David Fox helps to run these events in Cleveland.
A lot of samples end up just being either discontinued, and then where does this all go? And it ends up being thrown out a lot of time, or they just have so much stuff, they just keep hoarding and hoarding and hoarding.
About 5 years ago, some people at architecture and design firms around Cleveland, as well as a carpet company, all started talking about what to do with their unwanted material. They were spending a lot of money to send it to the landfill, so they held a one-day drop-off for companies to recycle it. Fox says they soon realized their trash might be treasure to artists and art teachers.
It was a program that just started as a one-day thing, and firms were able to come and drop stuff off, but it has turned into a yearly process, and now it's even gone to other cities.
Fox says they've already saved more than 100 tons of material from going to the landfill. Arts and crafts teacher Anita Gardner says it's also provided innumerable lessons for kids and teenagers at her community center.
They see now that anything can be art. Anything can be a craft, and it doesn't have to cost a lot of money to be beautiful.
Zero Landfill has been training architecture and design firms how to organize these events regularly. And new Zero Landfills are being held in Minneapolis, Louisville, and Boston this year. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
Coming up Saturday evening at 6, the state we're in looks at the right to a good boss. You'll hear stories from the United States, Canada, Argentina, Italy, and South Korea, from the worst to the best to having no boss at all. Join host Jonathan Gruber for the Right to a Good Boss Saturday evening at 6. Coming up tomorrow on the Afternoon Magazine, the growing season is fast coming to a close. Tomorrow we'll look at the season we've had, talk about what we might put in the ground right now, and maybe think about next year. I'm Celeste Quinn, and following the 1 o'clock news, I'll invite your telephone calls for Diane Noland and Chuck Voigt. They're with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Tuesday, September 15th, 2009. If you're an early riser, look in the eastern twilight tomorrow morning.
The waning crescent moon and blazing planet Venus shine close to one another now. They'll be close for the next few mornings. You should have no trouble spotting Venus because this world is the most brilliant celestial body to light up the sky after the sun and moon.
Depending on where you are on the globe, the moon and Venus will pair up most closely on either Wednesday or Thursday morning. If you live in the Americas, the moon and Venus will couple up most closely tomorrow morning. If you live in Asia, Australia, or New Zealand, you'll see the moon and Venus closest together on Thursday.
Although the moon and Venus can be seen from around the world, we in the northern hemisphere have a slightly better view than those in the southern hemisphere. From mid-northern latitudes, like in the U.S. and Europe, the moon and Venus rise in the east about 2.5 hours before the sun now. At mid-southern latitudes, like in South America, Australia, and New Zealand, the moon and Venus climb up above the eastern horizon only about an hour before sunup.
So watch for the two brightest heavenly bodies of nighttime, the moon and Venus. They'll grace the dawn and pre-dawn sky for the next few mornings. Look for them close to the horizon about an hour before sunrise. I'm Joel Block.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy, dedicated to preserving our planet